From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air Weekend. Today, comic W. Kamau Bell. He has a new Netflix stand-up special called Private School Negro. As an offshoot of his CNN series, United Shades of America, he did an ancestry search. What really got to him were the documents where his slave ancestors were counted as property.
And they were sort of tick marks on a piece of paper, not with their names attached, but like we know through the records that this person owned your family members and this tick mark here accounts for one of your, like, your great-great-grandmother.
Also, Kevin Whitehead reviews a new album of previously lost John Coltrane recordings. And former coal miner Frank Newsom talks about singing a cappella hymns in a style that's one of the oldest American music traditions. He sang this at his friend Ralph Stanley's funeral.
Someone closer than a brother.
First News. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, comic W. Kamau Bell, has a new stand-up special on Netflix called Private School Negro. One of the subjects he talks about in the special is raising his two biracial children in the Trump era. He and his wife just had their third child. Kamau has a CNN series called United Shades of America, in which he travels to communities around America, talking to people about the challenges they face. It's now in its third season. On the show's website, he has a three-part series about his ancestry search. His memoir, The Awkward Thoughts of W. Kamau Bell, will be published in paperback in August. Kamau, welcome back to Fresh Air, and congratulations, you just had your third baby 16 days ago. Whoa.
Yeah.
So are you in, like, in another zone right now?
Yeah, I mean, I'm always tired. I stay tired, like Mark Ruffalo is the Hulk. He's always angry. I stay tired. So it's just a new level of tired, and me and my wife. But now that this is the third daughter, we have a good system for how to do the. I basically stay up till about 3 or 4 in the morning, and then I'm allowed to sleep till about 10 in the morning. So we've got a good system. By that fourth kid, just kidding, that's not going to happen.
Did you ever expect you'd have three children?
No. I'm an only child, and defiantly and proudly so. And so two kids kind of made sense, but three kids just seems, there's a part of it that just makes me laugh, and it just seems weird, because it's just like, I always looked at families with a lot of kids like how many different ways can you combine the DNA? Like, it just seems like once you get two, isn't that about all it can do? So I'm sort of fascinated. I'm really fascinated with Asha to see how she ends up being different than her sisters.
Oh, so were you at the hospital? Were you there when she was born?
Yeah.
I'm saying hospital might have been at home. I have no idea where it was.
No. My wife doesn't roll that way. I'd have been happy to do it. I'd rather do it at home, but it's not really my choice, it turns out. So it's none of my business. In the hospital, and, you know, I was there. I always joke about, like, I wish I was a dad in the 50s where there would be a waiting room and cigars and a television, and I'd watch I Love Lucy, but that's not the case.
Do you think you're a calming presence or a source of anxiety?
Generally, I'm a source of anxiety for my wife. So, like, I think that my job during childbirth is to really try to diminish my source of anxiety, because I got a lot going on in my head, and she's the only one who hears it come out of my mouth all the time. People see me as a very calm person, but my wife knows that's not true. So my job is to really shut up and just do what I'm told and really try to limit my external monologue, which is difficult for me. Again, only child.
You're right. And a stand-up comic.
Your
job is to narrate things, yeah.
Exactly. My job is to point out things that I think are ridiculous, but when your wife's in the middle of giving birth, that's not a good time to sort of notice things. Did you ever notice? Not right now, Kamau, not right now.
So this is a good time to talk about the genealogy series that you did, since you have a new child now. So this is a kind of like adjunct to your CNN series. And in order to trace your genealogy, you brought your parents together. Your parents separated when you were a toddler. They were never married. And they hadn't seen each other for 9 years since your wedding. What was it like for you to bring them together and to see them together? What's it like for you to see your parents, who were so briefly together, reunite because of this project?
I mean, you know, looking back, that's the best thing I got out of it, was seeing my parents together in a situation that didn't cause them anxiety. Like, my wedding was kind of a nightmare for them. Like, I just think that, like, I don't know that they felt like it was a nightmare, but for me, it was like they really clearly had a hard time being in the same room together, which meant they were both late to everything. And so my wife's got this huge family. And I have two parents, and my wife's got this huge family, and my two parents are late to everything. So it just, this was an opportunity for them to come together when they didn't have any anxiety. They were happy to see their grandkids because they were around for the shoot. And, you know, they both were just sort of like having fun being on camera too. So, like, it was really beautiful.
Can you picture them as a couple?
No. I mean, I can see in my dad the parts of him that my mom would have been attracted to, but those parts are pretty buried deep at this point. My mom's a very, you know, academic, bohemian, activist, active Facebooker. And my dad is a very, like, you know, he's a guy who spent, like, most of his adult life in corporate America, and he came from nothing to get there. And so, you know, he's a very sort of buttoned up person, and my mom is completely unbuttoned. But the funny thing is that when we filmed the Ancestry series, the first episode, they're sitting together, and there was all this really funny rapport between the two of them. I could see them having like a back and forth of as if they'd been a couple years ago. And, you know, I think my dad has sort of put my mom in her proper context in his head. He was super close to his mom. He understands that I'm super close to my mom like he was to his mom, even if he's not my mom's best friend. Whereas my mom still sees my dad, I think, and is like, son of a... Like, it's still a little bit like fired up about some things. And I understand, understandably so, about some of those things. Because, you know, but it's just like to see them together, it was... I mean, I'm... One of the hidden benefits of my career in the last few years is that I get a lot of my really important moments recorded, and so I can actually go back and watch them.
So getting back to your ancestry search, your father and his family had made an assumption about a white man within the family tree, and this man was your father's great-grandfather, your great-great-grandfather. So he was a white man who fathered children with your great-great-grandmother, and the assumption was he was a slave owner, that he probably owned your great-great-grandmother, and that's why she bore his children. But what did you actually find out happened?
What we found out was that, according to Ancestry, there's no records of him ever owning anybody, which there would be records of that because it was like major property to own people. So there's no records of him ever owning anybody. He was listed at various points as a carpenter or as a farmer. He was also many years older than my great-great-grandmother, and all we know is that they had 13 kids together. They lived together at one point, but he never owned her, and their first kid was born while she was still enslaved. Like, there were still two more years before slavery ended. And so we don't know any of the details, but all of my life it's been like this slave owner had sex with his slave, who was your great-great-grandmother, and that's where the Bell family tree starts. And his last name is Dockery, and her last name was Bell. And I was like, why are their names different? And so now we're finding out that, like, she was probably owned by the Bell plantation, but he's just this dude, Dockery, who somehow comes across Francis and has a kid who is during slavery, but then has 12 more kids after that. So they clearly had a relationship. They lived together at one point. And then at one point they weren't living together, but they were apparently, according to Ancestry, living on adjacent plots of land. So maybe they were still technically living together. But once slavery ends, and for a while things get a little bit better, weirdly, in the South, but then it gets worse, that maybe they felt like they couldn't stay in the same house.
And they certainly couldn't have been married because it wouldn't have been legal.
No.
So what was your father's reaction to this contradiction of family lore?
There was a Tiger Woods fist pump, like when Tiger Woods used to win on a Sunday, like, which for my dad is a big deal. I could just see it like melting away, because this is the thing we've talked about. Like, you know, I remember when my grandmother was alive, his mom, and we'd sit around at like Thanksgiving, and there was always been a lot of talk on his side of the family about the family tree and about how far they could go back and what that meant. So for him, it was just to see him like sort of have to like recontextualize all of this, and also in some sense think of this guy Dockery as, you know, it's hard to say a good guy, but not a slave owner. You know, like there's a different context for this person now. I mean, my dad is just sort of like, I think he's still sort of processing it. And I think he's probably processing it with other family members.
So what was it like for you to see that document?
I mean, the documents that really hit me were the ones where members of our family were being counted as property. And they were sort of tick marks on a piece of paper, not with their names attached, but like, we know through the records that this person owned your family members, and this tick mark here accounts for one of your, like, your great-great-grandmother. That's the stuff that really shook me, because they call it the African-American brick wall, because once you get to, because you can't really get much further past slavery, because nobody's names are attached to them. They're just, again, they're just property. And so for me, that's the stuff that really just sort of, that sickens my stomach, because it's like, you know, my wife, who's white, can trace her heritage back as far to like the old countries, they call it like Italy and Portugal and you know, Ireland and England. Whereas mine, for the most part, is going to end in the South. You know, we're not going to be able to get much further back than that, other than the DNA telling you where your DNA comes from.
What about the DNA? Did you find out your DNA, and was it meaningful for you?
Yeah, for me, it's weird. For my dad and my mom, finding out the family stories was the stuff that they were really interested in, because these are names they've had their whole lives and ideas of how people lived that have been forming their head for a long time. But for me, the DNA was the fascinating stuff, because it's just sort of like, on one level, I was always sort of weirdly afraid of finding out about the DNA, because I felt like I'd seen so many black people like flip out when they found out they were more European than they expected they were. Like, so, like, you know, but like, what does that mean? And so for me, I was just like, I know I'm black. You know, the DNA can say I'm 100% Chinese, but it's not going to change my lived experience. But once I sat there and saw it, and you see like a map of Africa, and you see all the different places that your DNA pops up, and then you also see something that says like 1% Scandinavian, and you're like, what? Who? Like, where did that come from? It's super interesting to me, and you know, also funny to me, because apparently most black people in this country are 75%, you know, from Africa. And according to my DNA, I'm like 73% from Africa. And it's funny to me, because all my life I have felt like I wasn't black enough and been told by other black people that I wasn't black enough. And I'm like, I'm literally not black enough. I'm less black than most black people. So to me, that felt a little bit like, that makes sense.
No, I'm going to say it's the margin of error.
Yeah. No, I want to go with my not black enough theory. It sort of supports my whole narrative of life at this point.
So on your mother's side, there was something I thought was really interesting, which is that your great-great-uncle enlisted when he was 18 in 1864 to fight for the U.S. colored troops in the Civil War to fight to end slavery. That's an interesting fact.
Yeah, and this is something that there was no knowledge on my mom's side of the family about that. And so that was really interesting, because, you know, we went to this church that my mom's mom had gone to as a kid, and it's in Kentucky. And we went to this church, and in the church they had all these family records, and you could sort of see that the church for the African American community is where basically the census records are kept, because there we were always people, you know. So there's like a piece of paper on the wall that sort of listed all the original members of the church, and we could see that how many of those people were our family members. And so it really sort of struck me that like, the black church has been basically the government for black people in this country, because that's where you were a person. But we didn't know what these people did or what their jobs were. And so when Ancestry found this record that, you know, that he had enlisted to fight for the Union, you know, it makes you feel proud. We like to think of ourselves in my family, especially my mom's side of the family, as people who are actively in the world trying to make the world a better place. And at that point in history, as an enslaved black man, that's how you are going to actively make the world a better place. And it just feels like that's not in your DNA, but it feels like that's, again, part of our family DNA.
So you're in your third season of the CNN series United Shades of America, a kind of travel show, as was Anthony Bourdain's series Parts Unknown. Did you get to know him working on CNN?
Yeah. Yes and no. And mostly no, because there wasn't time. So the minute I got a job at CNN, people assumed that I was hanging out with everybody who worked at CNN. And I don't live in New York. Also, the show's a travel show. So I really had to, it took me time to get to know any of the people at CNN because I just wasn't there in New York where most of them are. But also because I was following my show, when my show first was about to premiere, Jeff Zucker said to me, there was a dinner with a bunch of people, and he's like, we've decided to put your show after Bourdain. And I knew that was a big slot. And I sort of took a gulp. I was like, whoa. And he's like, but if you don't want it, we don't have to, because everybody wants that slot. I got that by doing that, that Jeff Zucker was saying, we believe in your show and we want to give it the best chance to succeed possible. So from that point forward, me and Bourdain were linked together, and I'd never met him. It wasn't until the first, that we were nominated for our Emmy after season one, at the Emmys, that I saw him across the room. And I didn't even know if he would know who I was, just because I know, like, we're not all sitting around watching everybody on TV. And I saw him, and he looked over at me, and he made a beeline for me, and we talked, and he was just like, your show's great, we got to do something together sometime. And my wife took a picture of it that I've been sharing a lot recently, of me and him in our suits, and I look excited, because I was, and he looks like American James Bond, and he was just very welcoming to me. And so I would see him at like other various random CNN things, like maybe once or twice in the interim. And he was always like, we should work together. And then in March, we ended up shooting an episode of Parts Unknown in Kenya together. And I was there in Kenya for 11 days. And so that was really the time I got to be around him. And when I got to Kenya, I was super nervous because I was like, maybe he wants to shoot the show together because he thinks it's good for the show, but maybe he doesn't really, maybe he's not interested in knowing me. I don't know. I sort of understood him to be. And the legend around CNN was that Anthony is Anthony, and he either loves you or won't talk to you. And so I just sort of walked in very tentatively. And from the first moment I saw him at breakfast in Nairobi, he looked at me and smiled and motioned me over to his table. And he was sitting by himself. And we sat down and had coffee and, you know, and just sort of talked. And the time we spent together in Kenya, even if he had not passed away, was like some of the greatest time of my life, because it just showed me, like, there's sort of this sense in my career, and we've talked about this, I'm not even supposed to be here. Like, nobody's supposed, a comedian's not supposed to have a show on CNN. I'm certainly not supposed to be that comedian. And yet, here I am in Nairobi with Anthony Bourdain. And so at one point, we're on safari, and we're sitting on the side of this hill in Africa looking at, like, zebras and giraffe and hippos running around. Just like, it was just this, like, surreal experience. And we're drinking gin and tonics. And we're ostensibly talking about what it's like for me to go to Africa, and specifically because I'd never been to Africa before. So my first time I'm in Africa, I'm with Bourdain. It's another one of those experiences that I said earlier about, like, I'm having this major life experience, and it's being taped, so I'll be able to watch it again. And I just sort of took a moment, and it was like, to explain to him how surreal it was that I was sitting with him on the side of this mountain, this guy I'd watched on TV on my girlfriend's couch, who's now my wife, going, I would like to have a show like that someday. And now I'm sitting here talking to this guy. And I took the moment to tell him that, even though I was like, they're never going to use this in the show because this is not on theme. But I just felt like I was sort of overwhelmed and a little bit buzzed and just felt like I need to tell this man this. And we had a great time together. And at the end of the week, he gave me his phone number and was like, when you're in New York, text me, we'll go out to dinner. And I just felt like so, like, he was just a great dude. He was just a great dude. And I felt so validated.
By him.
Mm-hmm. By him and by his life force and by his, nobody is like him. And he did not suffer fools gladly. And so the fact that he would talk to me and give me his phone number and say, look him up, made me feel like I'm not a fool. I'm a comedian, but I'm not a fool. I'm somebody who's worth talking to. And he was like, when I was 44 years old, I was still dunking French fries. And now I've been doing this for the past 16 years. And I was just like, man, and I'm 45. I'm like, and I sort of had this moment of like, am I going to be doing this when I'm 61 like he is? And a little bit, I got scared by that because it just is, It was a crazy lifestyle. Like, he flew from some other shoot to Nairobi and then flew to some other shoot in West Texas. I flew from home, spent 11 days in Nairobi, and immediately flew back home and felt bad about being away from home for 11 days. And he had an 11-year-old daughter, and he loved her, and he loved his girlfriend, and he loved it. He even loved his ex-wife. He would call her his wife by accident. And it was just, you know, it's just it was a very spectacular, special experience that I will have forever, and I'm super sad that he's gone.
So you described Anthony Bourdain as a life force. Were you surprised that he took his life?
I was not a great friend of his. I feel like we were becoming friends, so I want to be clear about that. I don't want to speak on his internal life because I didn't know him that well, and there's many people who knew him better. But being around him, I could feel he was a heavy-hearted dude. And I have known heavy-hearted people my whole life. There's been times in my life where I've been heavy-hearted. My best friend is a heavy-hearted dude, so I know that feeling. So when I found out that he had killed himself, as much as it didn't make any sense to me, I also had to recognize, and I said this to my wife, he was a heavy-hearted dude. He was carrying a lot. And the schedule he was keeping is ridiculous. And I know that as a person who travels a lot, it's super lonely to travel, even if you're having a good time and doing the work you want to do. And dark thoughts can get in there.
How did you know he was heavy-hearted?
There's just some people, when you're around them, they're just a light energy that when they come into the room, their energy sort of brings light to the room. And Bourdain could do that, but you could feel him turning it on. But when he walked into a room, his presence was super heavy. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I just mean he felt like he had a lot going on and he was sorting through it. And there's nothing wrong with being heavy-hearted. Not all heavy-hearted people kill themselves. I want to be clear about that. But much like I was talking about me earlier with, like, my wife knowing how anxious I am, he probably didn't let it all out all the time, so he was probably dealing with it himself.
Kamau, it's always great to talk with you. Thank you so much, and congratulations again on your new daughter.
Thank you, Terry, and thank you for having me on.
The episode of Anthony Bourdain's series, Parts Unknown, that was shot in Kenya, has not been shown, at least not yet. W. Kamau Bell's new Netflix comedy special is called Private School Negro. His CNN series is United Shades of America, and his memoir, The Awkward Thoughts of W. Kamau Bell, will be published in paperback in August. On March 6, 1963, saxophonist John Coltrane's classic quartet recorded a studio session. The master tapes got filed away and eventually were lost. Now we know that Coltrane had given his own tapes from that date to his then-wife, Naima. That lost session has become a new album. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has more.
John Coltrane's quartet playing a new untitled blues, March 6, 1963. The newly issued music from that studio session is a trove of vintage Coltrane from a very productive period. The session wasn't unknown. Discographies list a few titles and untitled pieces. There are, in fact, three new tunes here. One performance from the date had been anthologized, Franz Lehár's Vilja, which Coltrane played on soprano sax. Now we also have a tenor version. And there's an early, more subdued run-through of a tune Coltrane would re-record, the Nat King Cole oldie Nature Boy. This 3.5-minute trio version, which begins and ends with a fade, has the feel of a preliminary study. Not that Coltrane's coasting. His busy variations preserve the melody's downward trajectory. Thank you. This music is collected on the double CD set, Both Directions at Once, the Lost album on Impulse. I am less convinced than the folks behind it that the fruits of this session were intended to be a freestanding album. Special projects aside, John Coltrane's early Impulse records drew from several dates, often mixing live and studio material. One mystery is how Impulse failed to place one new tune on LP, this untitled soprano anthem. There are seven tunes here in all, the second CD fleshed out with worthy, if sometimes lightly blemished, alternate takes. There are four versions of Coltrane's blowing tune Impressions, even though the live version, soon to be released on LP, had been in the can over a year. One of the new takes is for saxophone, bass, and drums, minus pianist McCoy Tyner. That's not such a big departure. Tyner often dropped out for minutes behind Coltrane on that one, leaving the rhythm to Jimmy Garrison's deep throb bass and the cataclysmic drumming of Elvin Jones. Elvin sounds particularly fine on this session. Playing with Coltrane made McCoy Tyner one of the most influential jazz pianists for decades. His splashy approach to rhythm stamped hundreds of colleagues. Tune after tune, he had the unenviable job of having to solo right after John Coltrane. It's not like he could start quietly and build from there. He had to pick up where the boss left off. Listen to Tyner preach on that new blues we started with. John Coltrane made some great records for Impulse in the early 60s, with Duke Ellington and Johnny Hartman and Eric Dolphy and his own quartet, records many people know by heart. I can't say this newly issued date is a revelation exactly. Even with those trios, there are no bombshells to make us rethink what we already know. So jazz fans will just have to make do with a fresh 88 minutes of well-recorded peak John Coltrane.
Kevin Whitehead writes for Point of Departure and is the author of Why Jazz. After we take a short break, we'll hear from Frank Newsom, who sings hymns a cappella in a style that's one of America's oldest musical traditions. He's a former coal miner who has black lung disease. His album of hymns has just been widely released. This is Fresh Air Weekend. ¶¶ Our next guest, Frank Newsom, sings in a style that's one of America's oldest musical traditions, lined-out hymn singing. The hymns are sung a cappella, with a leader singing out the first line of the song, which is then sung back by the congregation. Lined-out singing has its roots in 17th century England and is still sung in Appalachia in churches of the denomination Old Regular Baptist. Frank Newsom is a minister of one of those churches in Hayside, Virginia. It's called the Little David Church. If you're familiar with Ralph Stanley's version of the song O Death from the soundtrack of O Brother, Where Art Thou, you'll hear some similarities in Newsom's singing. In fact, they were friends and neighbors, and Newsom sang at Ralph Stanley's funeral. Newsom was awarded an NEA National Heritage Fellowship for his singing in 2011. Frank Newsom has a CD called Gone Away with a Friend. The songs were recorded at his church in 2006, and the CD is now widely released. It's pretty amazing how powerful his voice is, considering he was diagnosed with black lung disease in 1972 after working in Virginia's coal mines for 17 years. He was born in 1942 in Pike County, Kentucky, one of 22 children. He spoke with Fresh Air producer Sam Brigger. They started with the hymn Beulah Land from Newsom's CD.
I'm kind of homesick for a country to which I ain't ever been before. No said goodbye will there be spoken, for time won't matter anymore. I'm looking now across the river.
Frank Newsom, welcome to Fresh Air.
Glad to be here.
So you recorded the songs for the CD in your own church, the Little David Church. Does it feel different to you to sing these songs in your church or at a festival?
Well, I guess I ain't as scared or nervous in the church as I am anywhere else, you know.
Do you get scared singing out of your church?
Yeah. Yeah, I look at myself, I'm going to make a bad mistake, and I don't want that.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about your life. You were born in 1942 in Kentucky, and you were one of 22 children, is that right?
Well, I thought it was 22, but they got it down to 20. Yeah, I'm one out of 20 children.
And could you tell me about your home and where you lived?
We lived in the head of a holler. My daddy had a big farm, 169 acres. And we was poor people. We had nothing much. We raised what we eat. My mother would can stuff in the summer to pull us through to the winter. My daddy, he worked on the WPA, what they call it, 50 cents a day.
So was there a lot of music in your family? Did you play an instrument as a kid?
Oh, yeah. I learned to play a guitar when I was little. Yeah, I had three other brothers that could play. And one of them played a radio station in Ohio, Wellston, Ohio. He had a show that he played for a long time on.
And you would play with him on that radio station in Ohio.
Yeah.
You moved up there when you were a little older to work in a sawmill, is that correct?
Right.
What kind of music would you play?
Bluegrass. He was left-handed guitar player, and I was right-handed.
And I heard you built your first guitar when you were a kid, is that correct?
Yeah. About them nails in that board, and I got old stiff wire. Remember our cable wire, and I cut them off. I wrapped them around the nails and bent the nails over more you bent the nails, tighter they would get. And I called it a guitar anyhow. It made a sound.
Could you play it? You took a board and you stuck nails in it and put steel wire?
Yeah, I put it on my lap and everything, and I made a noise out of it.
So when you were singing back on the radio with your brother, is that a similar way to the way you sing now?
Pretty well, yeah. Oh, I sing bluegrass at the house for my grandyoungins.
Oh, you still play guitar?
Yeah. I know what to do, but I'm a little slow hitting the chords.
Well, I hope they forgive you for that. And how many grandchildren do you have?
I've got 5 grandchildren, 4 grandchildren, and 2 great-grandchildren. Five, okay. I was right, 5 grandchildren.
Who's that talking in the background?
That's my wife. She's a helping me.
Good thing she's there to correct you.
Yeah. Oh, wait. Oh, she's been my helpmate for a long time.
Well, that's good to hear.
Yeah.
Now, Ralph Stanley used to sometimes attend your church, and he would have you sing at his festivals?
Yeah.
So then when would you sing there?
Every time he'd call me up on the stand, he'd want me to sing Gone Away With a Friend. And that's the one that he said when I preached his funeral.
You sang that
as he wanted me to sing.
You sang that at his funeral?
Yeah.
Were you close friends with him?
Lord, yeah. For over 40 years we was.
And he would come to church, attend your church often?
Yeah, when he was able and wasn't tied up, he was there about every meeting time.
Well, why don't we hear the song, Frank, that you sang at Ralph Stanley's funeral? This is Gone Away With a Friend, which is also on your CD.
Gone away with a friend, someone closer than a brother, with somebody who loves you more than children, dad or mother.
So you left Ohio and you moved to Virginia, where your brothers got you a job working in a coal mine.
Right.
And it sounds like many people in your family worked in coal mines. And I read also that all the male members of your church, Little David Church, at some point worked in a coal mine. Did it feel like it was just inevitable that someday you would work in the mines as well?
Yeah. When my brother was working in the coal mine, my daddy working in a coal mine, I said to myself, when I grow up, I'll be working in the old coal mines. I worked for almost 20 years till I got in the shape of men now, and I can't hardly go now. But I'm glad that's the only way I had to make a living back in the late 50s and early 60s here in Virginia.
What was the work that you would do in the mines?
I'd load cars, 2-ton cars, with a number 4 shovel. You got a dollar a car for the company that you work for.
And did you enjoy this work?
Lord, yeah.
You worked for the mines for 17 years, but then you were diagnosed with black lung disease. And as the audience can hear, it's hard for you to breathe sometimes. What's your health like now?
It's a little bit better than what I have been. They got me on different medicine, and something is kindly helping me a little bit, better than what it was.
Oh, that's good. What do they have you on, a steroid or something?
Yeah, they got me on steroids. I take them every other day and other breathing medicine.
You have an asthma medication or something? An inhaler?
Right. I've got that.
Now, do you have to use an oxygen tank as well?
Oh, yeah. I use oxygen, but I ain't got it with me right now.
Well, I hope you don't need it while you're talking to us.
I do, too. Oh, we.
Well, it's amazing to me to think that you have black lung disease, which you describe as suffocating, but you're still able to sing these hymns with such power.
I'm glad you said that. Everybody tells me that. I can't explain it. I don't have the breath, hardly. When I walk up on the stand, I have to stand there a minute or two before I can talk. And you know, when I go to singing, seem like my voice is loud as it ever was. And they say, well, you done good to be smothering like you did. I said, well, it come from a higher power.
Now, you've said that coal mining was a good job for you. You liked the work and it made it possible for you to make a living and provide for your family. But it also sounds like it did a lot of harm to your body. Putting those facts on either side of a scale, how does it balance out for you?
When I was working in the mines, they had big fans blowing good air in there. You had to stay busy sometimes or you'd get a little cold. And I stayed busy loading coal. And in a way, it was fun to me. I didn't know I'd get in this shape. Back then, I didn't pay no attention. But I see what it's done to me now. But if I had it to do over and I lived here, I'd do the same thing.
So you don't regret it?
Yeah, I don't regret it.
Now, you said you came to be saved while you were working in the coal mines. Can you talk about that?
Yes. I got in trouble on account of my sins. And when I quit loading coal in the car, they put me on a motor to hook to the cars and take them to the outside and dump them and bring them back to where they could load again and get another load. Well, every break that I got, I was in trouble on account of my sins, the wrong that I had done between me and the Lord. I didn't want to die in that shape because I know where I go, my soul. I began to get off in the motor and go down in a break, and I'd try to pray to the good Lord to have mercy upon me. Lord, save my soul. I don't want to die like this. I kept on, till I give it all into the hands of the good Lord. Lord, here I am. Save my soul or I'm gone. And that's when I felt that he come into my life, was that day.
And then from then on, you started preaching at the Little David Church. Is that
yeah. Right? Later on, a year or two, I started preaching and telling the people the life that I used to live. I don't like it no more. Give me the life I've got now.
So after you were saved and you started preaching, and you had said that you were asking forgiveness for some of the sins that you felt that you had committed in life, when you were preaching, did you talk about those sins that you had committed?
Yeah, I told them that I'd used God's name in vain a few times. I drunk a little bit. I done other things that I wish I hadn't have done. But I guess that's the nature of everybody growing up. I have stole cigarettes out of people's car to smoke. I didn't have the money to buy them, and I stole a pack. Time or two out of that. And all them things was wrong, wasn't right, and I didn't feel safe the shape I was in.
So a lot of the songs that you sing, a lot of the hymns are about the troubles of life and the hardship that people deal with when they're alive. And it's about looking forward to getting to heaven and seeing the loved ones that have gone on ahead. And, you know, you started singing these songs when you were very young. You're now in your mid-70s and you have health issues. Do the words of these songs have a different meaning for you now?
Yes. They're more sweeter to me, and I understand it better. Now, like Amazing Grace, Gone Away with a Friend, Treasures That Money Can't Buy, and Beulah Land means more to me than what they used to when I was real young. It's got the old-time sound that there ain't another sound under heaven like it. It's a sound that you can't, when the Lord bless you, that you can't put music with it.
I have to say that some of your singing gives me the shivers in a good way. People say that to you?
Yeah. Lord, yeah. Oh, they come up to me and they'd say, oh, you made the hair stand up on my head and my arms. But I said, well, good. That's what it's all about.
Well, I'd like to end with one more song from your album. It's called Long Black Train. And, you know, some of the songs that you sing are hundreds of years old, but this is a new song. It's written by a singer-songwriter, Josh Turner. Why don't we hear it? Frank Newsom, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Oh, you're welcome.
Burning your ticket for that long black train, 'cause our victory in the Lord I say, victory in the Lord, cling to the Father and His holy name, and don't go riding on the long black train. There's a engine.
Frank Newsom spoke with Fresh Air producer Sam Brigger. Newsom's album of hymns is called Gone Away with a Friend.
And you wonder if the ride is worth the pain. He's just waiting on your heart to say, let me ride on that long black train. But you know that victory